Today, as Apple launches its new generation of iPhones, we look at how the company is faring in 2019. And The Guardian's Polly Toynbee on why she thinks the opposition parties should be refusing an election. Alex Hearn is The Guardian's UK technology editor and has been covering this field for 6 years.
I measure it in iPhone launches. I've been a technology reporter since the launch of the iPhone 5S.
The launch of the 5S was not all that memorable, especially when you compare it to the very first iPhone launch back in 2007.
Every once in a while, a revolutionary product comes along that changes everything.
I was 17, and I do remember the pitch of, we're here to launch three devices.
Three things: a widescreen iPod with touch controls, a revolutionary mobile phone, and a breakthrough internet communications device.
And they're all the same device.
These are not three separate devices. This is one device. And we are calling it iPhone.
And that was quite... That really did get to what was amazing about it, that it did feel like an impossible thing. Nokia's then chief executive at the time has gone on the record as saying he watched the launch and didn't believe it. He just thought they were lying.
Can Apple accomplish impossible things anymore? A dozen years after they wowed the world with the iPhone, tech geeks and reporters around the world will be watching as they present another annual product launch today, but not as intensely as before. The Apple of 2019 is a different beast. Alex's exclusive reporting on privacy breaches in Siri is just one of the many recent challenges that the company is facing. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, what's the future for Apple? I know this sounds strange in an episode about Apple, but this episode does discuss some adult themes that may be inappropriate for younger ears. Alex, you recently broke a cracking story all about Siri and what really happens to the recordings collected by your phone. What did you find?
We found that Apple operates this program, which it calls grading, which involves call centers essentially full of people working around the world in places like Cork and Barcelona, listening to Siri activations, listening to audio clips of normal Apple users who have activated Siri, who have said something that turns the device on or push the button that gets Siri listening. Those graders then check for accidental activations. They check whether or not the query was correctly transcribed. They check whether or not the answer that was given was what the user probably expected. All of these things that Apple uses to improve the service. The problem is, what Apple didn't do is tell anyone that this was happening.
An anonymous whistleblower reportedly told The Guardian newspaper that human contractors listened to recordings of some conversations while they worked to improve Siri's ability to understand you.
Apple disclosed that some of your recordings may be used to improve Siri, but that's not really the same as saying a complete stranger will be listening to some of your recordings and you won't know which ones, and you won't have an option of deleting sensitive ones before they're listened to. It's just a black box.
What sort of things did they listen to?
Well, this is the thing. Some quite sensitive recordings, it turns out. The graders I've spoken to have described hearing drug deals in process, hearing confidential medical consultations.
Drug deals? What do they do? Tell the police?
Well, no, they don't. They were told that it's not Apple's business, and even if it was, Apple has no way of tracking down the user, so what can they do? They were told to ignore it and move on. They also described regularly, and that is a direct quote, hearing couples having sex.
Fonset, how does having sex activate Siri? What, do you shout, hey Siri, when you're having sex? I mean, not you personally, but does what?
Well, I mean, you know, firstly, some people are called Siri, so I imagine that's not great in the bedroom.
Hey Siri, sorry.
So two things. from the graders. One is that apparently Siri can be activated by the sound of a zipper. The other is that people leave their Apple Watches on during sex.
But is your Apple Watch always listening to you?
Your Apple Watch is not always listening to you. But firstly, your Apple Watch has a button on the side, which if you press it in and hold it, triggers Siri. And that's how it's supposed to work. But depending on how you have sex, that button can be pushed in. And the other thing is that Apple Watches have a feature called Raise to Activate Siri, which means that if you lift your watch up and then begin talking, Siri is activated without you needing to say, "Hey Siri." I mean, we're getting quite mechanical here, but you asked.
It's really important to get mechanical right now. I need to know, Alex, how did you get this story?
One of the graders reached out to me. They decided that they were just too uncomfortable with what their work entailed to carry on doing it. They had seen reports that I'd done previously about other companies that had been caught out in exactly the same bind. In April, Bloomberg broke that Amazon had call centers full of people listening to Alexa recordings. In July, a Belgian TV station broke that Google had the same thing with Google Home and Google Assistant. Then I reported this story about Siri. And then after that, Facebook and Microsoft also got called into the same scandal. It's one of those interesting worlds where everyone in the tech industry thought they were safe because they basically knew that everyone else in the tech industry was doing the same thing. And meanwhile, the rest of the world thought that this was unacceptable. And the minute normal people found out that this was what using a voice assistant meant, an awful lot of them had very strong complaints.
And obviously, I don't want someone in a call center somewhere listening to the type of things that you're describing, but it's not particularly hurting anyone, is it?
This is actually a disagreement that I had with Apple in the process of reporting this. I don't think privacy breaches need to lead to specific harm to still be bad. Initially, Apple's response was to confirm that the grading program exists, but to argue that it had been detailed in their privacy documents, and that though they didn't explicitly mention humans were involved, they had all of the required consents and that it was all above board. That lasted about a week. And in that week, the reaction to the story had grown to such an extent that Apple realized it had screwed up. It then promised a review and a suspension of the program until it could build in controls to let people opt in or out of it. And that's what happened.
Apple is apologizing and promising to make changes after it revealed that contractors listened to audio recordings of customers using Siri.
It suspended the program, and then 6 weeks later, it announced the completion of its review with a extremely rare for Apple apology.
I don't think I've had an apology. Have you?
It's on the website.
That's a weird sort of apology. And it's not the only thing that you've been leaked. You've had another great story just the other day.
Yeah, another Siri grader gave us a bunch of documents, Apple's internal guidelines on how to write for Siri. And the most interesting thing there was their guidelines on how to deal with sensitive topics, things like feminism, which advise writers to not engage, deflect, and only then inform rather than give an opinion.
Right. I'm not sure that I would describe feminism as particularly sensitive, but there you go. Now, Alex, we've spoken about these products before, and you told me not to worry because until you say the wait word, they don't listen to anything anyway. Are you still so relaxed? I mean, do you use Siri? Do you use Alexa?
The process of reporting this story has actually fundamentally changed my mind on these things. It remains true that they are not listening until they hear the wake word. What I didn't fully grasp when I got my first Alexa, what I didn't fully grasp was how regularly they mishear it. You know, anyone who has these things has had the experience of it binging from
the corner. Especially if you're called Alex. I didn't even think of that.
Yeah, we've all had the experience of it binging randomly at inopportune times. And that, combined with the fact that those random accidental activations were being listened to by real people, just blew my trust in the companies that operate these systems. And without trust, what you suddenly have then is a company you don't trust with a hot mic in your house.
What is Apple's big picture approach to privacy?
Apple's pitch is best summed up by an advert they ran in Las Vegas this January during the Consumer Electronics Show. They bought the side of a building and put up the words, "What happens on your iPhone stays on your iPhone." It was a pretty direct swipe at Google. As we've discussed here, the way Google works and the way Android works is Google collects all of the information it possibly can about you. And then Google argues it uses that information to build artificial intelligence. Apple's argument is that that's unnecessary. Apple instead says what we do is when we do artificial intelligence, we do it on your iPhone. We don't send stuff back to the cloud. We don't send stuff back to our servers. We don't know anything about you. That is a genuine and important difference. It is a difference which is self-serving for Apple.
Let's be cynical about this. Basically, Apple see this as a competitive advantage.
And more than that, it's a competitive advantage that stems from the fact that they're quite bad at AI. Apple, once upon a time, would have killed for access to the amount of data that Google had to be able to build AI products like those Google has built. But Apple didn't have that data, didn't build that AI, and now it's turning that lack of AI and that lack of data into a commercial advantage.
I mean, one thing I'm very interested in is the relationship between tech companies and China. Does Apple promise the same levels of privacy and security to customers in China?
It promises it. Apple is in a unique situation with China. On the one hand, it's got some positives because the company runs very few public-facing content distribution networks. It doesn't have a social network. It doesn't have a video sharing channel. It's managed to dodge a lot of the really thorny questions of censorship, although it does still heavily censor things like the Chinese App Store. But then beyond censorship, Apple has a problem that it both has an enormous market in China.
China was the real hotspot for Apple. iPhone sales in the world's second largest economy spiked 87%, thanks in large part to the popularity of the iPhone 6S and 6S Plus.
And it has an enormous manufacturing base in China. And because it makes and sells so many iPhones every year, shifting that manufacturing to another country would be beyond the realms of anything that a publicly traded company has ever done, really. Which means that it sits in the middle of a trade war.
We begin with breaking news out of Washington just moments ago. President Trump talking everything from tariffs to Apple to the dollar to
Fed. It just has to try and weather the storm.
And you have reported quite recently on controversy within China linked to Apple.
The Chinese government views privacy differently. Put it that way. Google recently announced that it had discovered and helped Apple disrupt an enormous, unprecedented effort to hack iPhones on the scale of thousands a week that we now believe was being focused on the Chinese Uyghur community and probably from the Chinese state. It was the first time we've seen anything that could take control of that many iPhones at once. It was millions of dollars of weaponized security vulnerabilities. It's been disrupted now, but it went on for 2.5 years. And the fact that it went for 2.5 years without being detected suggests that there are just as many campaigns similar to it running all the time that we're only spotting when it's far too late.
And this was part of the government trying to control the Uyghur population?
We believe.
And how have Apple responded?
On their internal blog, they've posted a statement which takes issue with some of Google's reporting, specifically the idea that it was an attack en masse. Apple highlighted that it only affected a few dozen websites that were part of the Uyghur community.
Okay, we've talked about all the controversies and the fact that while the Apple launch today will be of great interest to you, it's not what it once was. But that said, these days we do definitely take it for granted that we all have these devices, particularly iPhones, on us wherever we go. Just how big a deal has the iPhone been in terms of Apple's success?
It made them the first publicly traded company in the history of the world to be worth more than $1 trillion. That was last summer. That valuation has fluctuated since, but it's still worth well north of $900 billion. And although its peers, companies like Google and Facebook and Amazon, have valuations in that same realm, Apple earns far, far more money than any of those companies. The big thing about Apple, the fear for the company's shareholders in the last few years, has been that it seems to have settled into a pattern of selling iPhones to millions of people every year, and those same people buying new iPhones every 3 years, 2 years, but it's not growing. And in a world where growth is king, that's worrying if you own Apple shares. Instead, the company has pivoted to what it calls the services narrative, broadly that rather than selling iPhones to more people, it will sell more things to the people who do own iPhones. AirPods or an Apple Watch or an iPad, all of those little optional extras, you can expect to see Apple doubling down on them.
Oh, so they make you like an Apple addict.
Exactly.
Okay, so Apple is essentially a company that isn't as exciting as it once was when you were getting your new products many years ago, but still produces technology that sells very well. Lots of people want multiple Apple products. Its launch won't be the moment of this month, but you'll report on it probably.
Oh, yeah. And the thing is, it still will be the moment of this month in the tech community when the second largest company in the world announces everything it's going to do for the next 6 months in 1 2-hour show. It's worth paying attention.
But clearly we are in an evolving technological world, a world in which artificial intelligence is becoming increasingly important, a world in which there are some contradictions between Apple's position on privacy and its ability to compete in that market, and a world in which there are controversies of which Apple has been part with your great exclusive on Siri. 5 years from now, will anyone be paying attention to the launch of the next Apple product then?
5 years, yes. The smartphone is firmly embedded. Its successor hasn't reared its head, whatever that is. In 5 years, smartphones will still be important. The question for me is sort of in 10 or 20 years, as whatever replaces the smartphone, maybe that's smart glasses that we wear on our heads, maybe it's AI that, you know, we all walk around wearing one AirPod and just have conversations with the internet. Maybe it's something that no one has even started trying to build yet. The question is, whatever that is, does Apple have the expertise to even be in that market, let alone build something that is as influential in the successor to the iPhone as it was in the iPhone? It hopes that it does, partially because it hopes that there will be a privacy backlash that will squash its competitors, and partially because it hopes that, well, it hopes that whatever comes next doesn't require as much of that AI expertise. Maybe the downside is maybe we are talking about a world in which, you know, we all have a personalized AI and we go, privacy's dead, I love my AI friend, they help me do everything. It's a shame that Apple doesn't build one anymore, but oh well, Google or Amazon or Facebook do it for me.
Or a new company.
I mean, I still don't think it'll be a new company, but maybe.
Alex, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Alex Hearn. If you're interested in technology, which if you've got this far, you hopefully are, then I strongly recommend our Chips with Everything podcast. Do subscribe and have a listen to the latest episode featuring Alex. I'm always keen to have a chat about the content of our podcast afterwards, so if you have a chance, tweet me at Anushka Astana with any thoughts. Coming up, why isn't Labour lapping up the opportunity of a general election? Now, Guardian columnist Polly Toynbee on Labour's strategy amid a Brexit crisis.
For an opposition party to refuse to hold an election is an astounding, extraordinary event. Unheard of, never happened before. One of the rules of politics is that every opposition always wants an election tomorrow, even if they don't really. But in theory, they have to look as if they're ready for the fight any day. Jeremy Corbyn has said over and over and over again, and so has everybody else, we want a general election. Only a general election can resolve this, put this back to the people, let them decide. Suddenly, Boris Johnson calling an election is a kind of death trap for those who want to avoid no deal. if he called an election under the Fixed Term Parliament Act, he has the right to choose the date. So if they vote to have an election, he doesn't even have to say what the date is as they take the vote. So he would certainly try and take the election over the 31st of October, which means we would go out without a deal. Parliament wouldn't be sitting. There would be no way to prevent it. It would be straight over the cliff edge with, you know, an unelected prime minister, a rump of a parliament, no majority. It would be a constitutional catastrophe. Well, of course, the Conservatives can jump up and down with glee and say, look, you're frit, you're afraid, you're ducking out of an election because you're behind in the polls, which Labour is quite severely. That really isn't the case this time, because all of the opposition parties are absolutely united on this, and they're all in rather different positions electorally. And there's no reason to believe these polls anyway, and there's certainly no reason to believe the polls would be much different after the 31st of October. So I don't think there's really any truth in that. Jeremy Corbyn was himself quite reluctant to agree to this strategy of refusing an election. He thought it looked a bit ridiculous because no opposition ever done it before. But he too has been persuaded that this really is the only way to prevent Boris Johnson taking the country out of the EU with no deal and no further discussion. Parliament has been prorogued. They've gone home after voting against having a general election. Boris Johnson will be quite relieved to be able to say, this Parliament is chaotic and anarchic. I am the only person who is decisive. I'm the only person who's going for a clean break, no deal Brexit. On the other hand, I think that Jeremy Corbyn and indeed the rest of his Progressive Alliance will be quite united when they return in October. And I think we'll see a real show of strength from them. We're very likely to get a general election as soon as possible after the 31st of October. Everybody will want one at that stage. So by the end of November, possibly beginning of December, I think there will be a unanimous sense that it has to happen. This is a broken parliament. But nothing is certain. Nothing is known. It's the most extraordinary time in politics in any of our lifetimes.
That was Polly Toynbee. Do read her brilliant columns at theguardian.com. My thanks to Alex Hearn and Polly Toynbee. This episode was produced by Mithili Rao and Rosie Gillett. Sound design was by Axel Cucutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.